Welcome to the Valley College Connection, where John Kawai and Scott Wigand, two Valley professors, engage in a conversation about success with educators and students. Each week, they'll sit down with a different guest to find out ways each of us have had to plan, persevere, and overcome to where we are now. The show will also highlight resources and services that are working to make a difference at Valley College.
We are joined today by Dr. Barry Gribbins, president of Los Angeles Valley College. Thank you so much for joining us, President Gribbins. We're really glad that you could sit down with us and have this conversation.
Thank you, Scott. It's my pleasure to join you.
As we do with all of our guests, we'd like to invite you to take us on the path that brought you to Valley College. And if you could take it as far back as you're comfortable going, you know, detailing some of your experiences, what school was like for you along the way, successes that you might have had, challenges that you might have had. And John and I, as we typically do, will interject with questions and bring us up to the present where we're at now at Valley College.
Sounds good. Thank you, Scott. I'm from the LA area, so I've lived in the Los Angeles area my whole life. I grew up in Santa Clarita, which is just maybe 22 miles north of Santa Clarita, so fairly close. The area, of course, back then was much smaller than it is now. Santa Clarita, for example, only had about 25,000 residents back then. Now it's perhaps 300,000 folks. So it was a much smaller town back then, and kids had a lot more free range to ride their bikes all over the valley. The elementary school I went to was called Old Orchard. It was within walking distance from my house, which every kid in the neighborhood, you know, walked to school in the same. We had paseos up there, so you could walk to school on these paths just designed for kids. I enjoyed school, but I wasn't the best student. In math, I think I always excelled better than English. And a lot of times in English, I struggled a bit, with the one exception. One time in third grade, I won an award for a haiku I wrote. And that was where I peaked in English with that one award.
So you had a bend towards the creative side with your creative writing as a young student.
It could have been the math elements of writing haiku too. I'm not sure about that.
The formula behind it.
exactly. I later found out it wasn't until, ironically, a week after I got my PhD from USC, I found out I had a learning disability, binocular dysfunction. So my entire time going through school, I had a learning disability that I didn't know about. And it affected how I process information, how my two eyes process information, which accounts for why I always struggled in English, but did much better in math. Because visually processing words as you read takes a lot of coordination with your two eyes, and might not working really well together caused a lot of problems as I would read.
What kind of things would happen? Would you skip words or skip lines? Or,
you know, I just wouldn't get the words in an order that made sense to my brain. And it would cause me to have to read really slowly and over and over. As you get older, just like people with dyslexia, your brain learns different strategies to piece information together, even if visually the information's not coming in right. And you ultimately end up finding ways to compensate for how that information is processed by the brain. So as an example, ultimately, I did okay. You know, I should back up. The reason why it was never diagnosed is I always did okay in school, including in English. I did fine. Wasn't a great student, but did fine. Math, I always did really, really well. But since I was never doing poorly, it was never called out and really assessed. But over the years, like I said, I kind of developed strategies, unconsciously developed strategies to compensate for the way that information's processed. And to this day, I do pretty well, but I am the worst editor because my brain will naturally change words to how I think they ought to be. So if a word is misspelled, if letters are flipped around, if things are not in the right order, I literally can't see it. I can read a sentence 100 times that has an error in it, and I just can't see the error. So it's kind of interesting how that all plays out. But things ended up okay for me over the years. I ended up getting my PhD at USC, so that worked out okay.
Yeah, something similar happened to me too, where I have a very similar learning disability. And as I studied it, I found out that 1 out of 3 CEOs have this learning disability, something similar to you. And I think 1 out of 3 entrepreneurs have this. So they found that compensating for these visual learning disabilities, it'll either completely drop you, because they found people in prison have a larger proportion of people with these visual issues. But I think MIT did this study where they found out that if you took words in a word problem, a math word problem, and you made them so small that people would have to reread it, that you couldn't just read it fast, but you'd have to reread it over and over, that people would process and answer the questions much better. So something about having to reread a word problem really carefully and slow you down, it's something that's supposed to help people with math.
Oh, that's interesting. Makes good sense, too.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. Many famous folks that have achieved great things in life have learning disabilities just like us.
Yeah. Steven Spielberg has it. The guy who started Charles Schwab has it. I think the guy who started IKEA has it. What's it? Virgin Atlantic, that CEO has it. So it's really common with very, very successful people, and it's very common with people in prison, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's like the two extremes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, thankfully, I ended up on one path and not the other. A couple of other comments I can offer too about life, you know, in the early years. The schools I went to were all terrific. You know, I always had a lot of amazing teachers. Like I said, I wasn't always an amazing student, but I had amazing teachers. Many of them just had indelible marks that I'm so appreciative for. In high school, from Old Orchard, I went to junior high school, Placerita. And then I actually went to high school here in the Valley, not too far from Valley College, at a high school named Alamany. Again, at Alamany, I just had amazing, amazing teachers. The school had a really strong curriculum. It also had a really strong ethic, where the expectations weren't that we were just not getting in trouble, you know, not getting into fights, things like that, but a much higher ethic where you actually had to love each other. And that, I think, carried through with me even today, and made a big impression on how I approach working with others, at least how I strive to work with others. And again, just some amazing faculty, a psychology professor I had, Tom McClanahan, and wonderful, wonderful folks. It was at that time, too, that I took my first community college class. I took chemistry as a dual enrolled student from a professor named Eric Erickson, a chemist, though, not the psychologist. And that was just an amazing experience. The lab work was a lot of fun, and just a real treat to be able to take that class as a dual enrolled student. And I think in many ways, that's why I ended up going to the community college after I graduated from high school, just because I had such a strong experience with that professor. It just naturally led to me continuing on. And the faculty, again, at the community college were absolutely amazing. About 10 years later, I ended up working at that same community college as an administrator, ultimately as the deputy chancellor at the college. And I got to work with many of those faculty who I'd taken classes from, and develop some friendships that will certainly be lifelong. Just amazing, amazing people at the community college.
So let me reel you back a little bit. So which community college was this? And when you entered community college, what did you think your major was going to be?
Oh, great questions. So this was College of the Canyons in Santa Clarita, where I grew up. My major actually changed every semester. So from my first semester, I think I might have been pre-med, and I later was business, engineering. Ultimately, I settled in on psychology. And then when I graduated, my focus at that time was psychology.
With that, let me reel you back a little bit further. Two questions. You had noted that you had a psychology professor at your high school. And so I'm wondering to what extent that professor made an impression on you. And then you also mentioned that the high school had this sort of ethic of love that was part of the identity or the curriculum of the school. Can you share just a little bit about like how, what did that look like, or how was that taught to the students?
Yeah, the professor, his name, Tom McClanahan, he did have a really big impression on me. Brilliant, brilliant man. Great, great sense of humor. Super, super sharp. The way he approached the curriculum was absolutely amazing. It wasn't so much focus on memorization of a whole bunch of facts, but rather helping us understand different approaches to seeing why people do things that they do, why people have different behaviors. And from kind of classic perspectives, whether it be a behaviorist perspective, psychoanalytic, you know, any of the different major areas of psychology. But it was just fascinating to approach and see the world through his lenses. And I found throughout my college career, the great professors all do that. They help you see the world through new lenses, through in new ways, ways that you had never seen the world before.
That makes me think of, I'm sorry, I just had to interject because we talked about it before, Barry, this idea of a light the fire course as we're having this conversation at Valley. But that's a great sort of way of kind of thinking through what that means, this ability to see the world in a different way. And after we're exposed to that as students, it's really hard, you know, not to have the proverbial fire lit, that it's very exciting to have that experience.
Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up too, Scott, about the light the fire course, because as I mentioned, the first course I took was chemistry. The first college course I took was a dual enrolled course as a chemistry. And one of my favorite memories, I always loved doing the chemistry experiments, but one of my favorite memories, I was taking the course with one of my friends and we were heating up something in a test tube. He asked the professor, Eric Erickson, if he needed to use a test tube holder. And Eric kind of shrugged his shoulders, it's up to you. And so he decided he was going to be tough, decided that he was just going to hold the test tube in his hand as he heated it up. And then all of a sudden the test tube started shooting out all sorts of sparks and gray stuff started shooting out. And he started to panic. And the professor was standing over his shoulder saying, you know, to be tough, you know, as he's panicking, freaking out. Of course, as an administrator right now, I probably wouldn't have been too happy with it, but it was quite an experience and quite literally lighting the fire, you know, igniting that passion and just leaving these great, great memories behind.
That's a great story.
Yeah. And Scott, you asked about how the school approached the kind of promoting an ethic of love.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting question. That high school is a faith-based high school. So a lot of it kind of was embedded in the faith, but it was really just sort of expectations that were conveyed in subtle ways, you know, in terms of how you treated one another. And I'm not sure exactly how it was achieved, but just generally that's the way it worked. Everyone just, I think, had a lot of regard for each other and treated each other well. We didn't, you know, there might be squabbles as all teenagers have, but we all shared, you know, those common ideals about treating everyone with love and kindness. And, you know, if you mess up, that's okay. We all mess up, you know, and we all just try to do better next time. So it's kind of just a really neat experience.
Was that a Jesuit high school or a Catholic high school?
It was a Catholic high school. It wasn't a Jesuit high school, but there were a couple of Jesuits that were there.
I really do think that we've had a number of professors who have been on here who have talked about just the value of their Catholic education and whether they were Catholic or not. And I really do think that something, you know, the focus of the Catholic Church to say that education was going to be a central sort of focus of their mission, I think it bears itself out in a lot of people that we've interviewed.
Yeah, yeah. It certainly is a good compliment, and I do appreciate that the focus of the schools, Catholic schools, is to promote people understanding, learning, questioning, trying to be welcoming and inclusive and not limiting as to who participates in those programs.
So when you were at College of the Canyons and a psych major, what was the big dream? Were you thinking about being a counselor, or at that point were you thinking someday I'm going to be president of a college?
You know, it's kind of funny. I at one point did talk to the college president about what her path was to becoming a college president. At the moment, I think I was more looking at being a clinical psychologist, but we did have that conversation way back when. And then a few years later, she ended up hiring me as an administrator, and I worked with her for 19 years before coming here to Valley.
Wow, what it's really interesting to hear sort of the experience of school from primary to secondary to community college, all within that Santa Clarita Valley there. Where did you end up going after College of the Canyons as a student? Where did you transition to get your bachelor's degree?
After College of the Canyons, I went to Cal State Northridge. So I was back here in the Valley. And keep in mind that during high school, I was here in the Valley. So I spent a lot of time roaming all over the Valley while I was in high school. Most of my friends were down here in the Valley. We spent all of our time going to places like Winnetka Drive-In, back when Winnetka was a drive-in, not a multiplex theater. And other places around the Valley. So going to college after College of the Canyons, going to Cal State Northridge is kind of a natural next step. There I studied psychology and had, again, some amazing professors that I learned a lot from, especially in statistics. I did take a lot of math. I think I was one of the very few psychology majors to take linear algebra, so three semesters of calculus and linear algebra. I was certainly the only psychology student in the linear algebra class I was in at CSUN. Everybody else was an engineering major. But great, great experience at CSUN, great preparation. From there, I went on to USC for my master's and my PhD. My master's was in instructional design and instructional technology. At that time, I was thinking about going into designing educational programs. So really quite a big change from the early days in psychology. But while I was at USC, I also took a lot of classes in educational psychology, statistics, and measurement. Again, had some amazing professors, Bill Michael, Dennis Hosevar, some just truly amazing folks, Robert Retta, Myron Dembo, who we've had here at Valley College a few times. I actually taught for Myron for 2 years while I was at USC and had some just amazing experiences learning about student motivation, how folks learn, and as well, research methods, statistics, measurement, just a fabulous complement. And that experience, unfortunately, is not replicated too often anymore. A lot of those programs there are costly and have folded up over the years, but it was a great experience for me.
Do they still continue to have their sort of, I remember they had some data group for community colleges. Is that still existing? Yes. I used to go there every year for their data group and their summary of LECCD data. And for some reason in recent years, that's just all sort of dried up.
Yeah, that was a group that was started by Estella Ben-Simon, and it was actually started years after I left there. Got to keep in mind, I'm kind of old, and It was decades since I've been there. I actually finished with my PhD in 1995, and Estella was just coming on to the faculty at that time. From there, I left. I went over to UCLA, across town to UCLA, and was doing research there. But those were really interesting projects and efforts that Estella and other folks developed.
And they're still active, John. Estella and her team were just leading a whole series of workshops last semester on guided pathways and whiteness. That kind of think tank, Center for Urban Education continues to, you know, put a lot of work out. And yeah, it was just recently that they did an analysis of LACCD and our equity plans. And I think provided some really useful insight that, you know, that we're even looking at now as we kind of move forward with our own equity work on the campus.
Well, if it's an open meeting, invite me because I love their work. Anything that they've ever published that in a meeting I have saved in the folder because it's outstanding work.
So I will invite you to the next meeting. Hold on, John, one second. I have to go back a second because Barry mentioned two things that I wanted to dig into a little bit about you with USC. One of them is, and we talked about this before in another conversation, your work with Myron Dembo, which, you know, is really exciting to me because I first met Myron back in early 2000, 2001 or two. We had a grant on campus here. And I think, I don't know what edition of his book it was in, but, you know, Self-Regulated Learning, we were using that and we invited Myron. We had a really strong relationship with him. And the project director for the grant, Deborah Harrington, who's now at our district, had connected with Myron. And my goodness, I can't tell you how many workshops we did together with him. And it was for me when I was a graduate student. And so as I was a graduate student going through my teaching practicum, I was, you know, helping Myron and taking notes and summarizing the workshops. And then that relationship continued with Myron up until just a few years ago, even with our Teaching Innovations Academy grant. So we really connected with that work about student motivation and self-regulated learning and kind of rethinking, you know, the importance of what we call now essential academic skills. And this idea of how important it is for all faculty to have a role in reinforcing what those skills are in their teaching practices. And so the fact that you had the chance at USC to work with him and study with him it's just really exciting. I feel like the perspective that must inform of how you're sort of looking at the college and understanding that kind of teaching aspect of the students is really powerful. The other question I had for you, Barry, though, is that I came across when I was Googling something. It looked like you had published a paper that was on English or reading acquisition. And there were references to Stephen Krashen there. And we had Krashen on campus here many years ago, too, as another kind of workshop as we were doing ESL and sort of, you know, effective fallacy and trying to figure out the best way to help students. Can you share what that kind of work was? And you'd mentioned at the beginning of the podcast how reading was a challenge for you. And then years later, you were publishing papers, academic papers, on reading acquisition.
Yeah, that was another wonderful experience. I first met Steve Krashen actually in the lounge in the School of Education at USC. That's on the first floor of the building in the Rossier School of Education. And I didn't know Steve at the time, but I think he might have known that I like stats and research methods. And he just came up to me and started asking me research questions and statistics questions. And he was just a guy in jeans and a polo shirt asking me these questions. So I was sharing my thoughts on research design. I later found out it was Steve Krashen, who's just an amazing world-renowned scholar on language acquisition. Very controversial at that time, because he was kind of the founder of the whole language, one of the founders of the whole language movement, which was by far moving away from phonetics approach to language acquisition. So he was very controversial, but brilliant. From that initial conversation, he continued to ask me questions about research methods. And then I joined his team in doing research projects. It was an amazing experience working with his team as well. Each of us came to the team with our own expertise at the same time when we produced work. So if my expertise was research methods, when I approached the project, we passed around drafts of the paper. It was really an expectation that everybody contribute to the draft with all the comments that we might have to make it as strong as possible. But he just promoted just an amazing sense of teamwork that that we should all aspire to. And it is kind of fun that in the end, I ended up with, I think, 4 peer-reviewed published papers in language acquisition, co-authored with Steve. So it was a wonderful experience.
That's so cool. Yeah, it's not an academic word to describe it, but I think it's very cool. You know, part of it that I think is really great, too, is that both of those scholars, both Myron and Dr. Krashen, you know, is kind of the outsider looking at their work and how we've used it in professional development, is that there really does seem to be a advocacy or a real belief and buy into what I think is generically called sort of student-centered learning, and sort of a move away from this kind of sage on the stage, you know, let's just lecture as students with both of their works. You know, so the fact that you had the opportunity to study with them and work with them in this sort of capacity is really exciting in terms of how that, you know, I'm sure obviously informs, you know, the work that you're doing now at Valley College. And as we kind of think through all these challenging questions that have to do with student success and completion and professional development and how all these things get tied together, it's just exciting to sort of hear some of those details.
They were amazing experiences and really shaped how I approach education, for sure.
So for students who've never gotten a PhD, describe what was the whole experience like of going and getting your PhD and doing research? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, a great question. And I'll share some comments that are the same same thoughts that I share students that I've had when I've taught. So whenever I teach psychology classes, especially at the community college level, these are the same thoughts. To me, the hardest part of education, the most challenging level of education, is the first 2 years of the undergraduate education, lower division education, what we do at the community college level. Folks, I think, oftentimes find the first 2 years of college to be challenging, and many of us struggle from time to time with different courses. And I always try to remind students the next level is actually easier. It doesn't get harder when you go to the upper division and then to your master's and then to your PhD. Each level actually gets easier. I think part of it might be that there's just an expectation or an assumption when you're in graduate school that you're smart, you don't have to prove yourself anymore. So there's less of a focus on whether or not you're going to pass a course and more of a focus on ideas and concepts and theories. But also the volume of work is a lot less. So one tends to study the broadest number of things the first 2 years, and then you get to focus your attention a little bit more narrowly at each of the subsequent levels. And then at the PhD, you just have a tremendous amount of flexibility. One usually takes just 2 or 3 classes at a time, even if you're full-time. You don't take more than 3 classes at a time. You get to start engaging in research projects, and that will look differently depending on what your interest is. So you can really pursue and study and try to learn about anything in the world that you want. And that's rewarding and exciting to do in it all in itself. Work, as John, you and Scott were pointing out, with world-renowned scholars oftentimes, which is a lot of fun, you know, and to see how they approach their work and the world around them.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think when you finally get to that PhD level, you actually get to work with your professors as people. And that's something that's exciting, right? Rather than, because you're not really engaging with a book, because, you know, it takes 10, 15 years for something to get in the book. And what you're trying to do is do something that's never been done before. So now you're talking about conversations. What are your thoughts? What do you guess would happen? What's your intuition? And all of a sudden, that's a lot more fun than reading a book.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the other thing that's kind of interesting too, that I learned in the process, especially in graduate school, some of the most interesting, brilliant work is hard to get published. We talked about Steve Krashen. Steve Krashen's work was really hard to get published because the peer review process is such that the editor of a journal sends out the manuscripts to three people to review. And the three people have to agree that they like it. If somebody doesn't like it, given the volume of manuscripts that are submitted for publication, oftentimes things won't get published. Steve was so brilliant, creative, innovative, and in many ways forward-thinking. He could never get three people to agree on his manuscripts. There was always somebody who just didn't like his theories. They didn't agree with them, and they didn't like them, and they would always vote no, you know, in terms of whether or not he should be published. So we oftentimes really struggled to get his work published. On the other hand, Bill Michael, who I did a lot of work with and published with, he was the editor of the oldest psychometrics journal ever. And he was the editor of the journal for a long, long time, especially the validity section. So we had a near 100% acceptance rate when, of course, publishing to his journal. So there's a little bit of, I think, social dynamics, let's say, in determining how things get published. But it's fascinating, and it underscores things might not always go out, end up like you like. You might get some disappointments. You might get rejected, and that's okay. You know, you still continue to pursue an understanding of the world, expand your own knowledge and how you see things, and don't let setbacks or failures get in your way. It's just a natural course of learning. It's something that you have to embrace. You have to accept. You won't like it. None of us like failing, but we have to fail. It's one of the most important things that we do in life.
Yeah, there's something strange about if you're revolutionary, there may not even be a journal that is created for it, right? So like incremental change, there's a spot for you. But if you're revolutionary, a lot of times you just end up having to write your own book.
Yeah, that's right.
Those are the dangerous ideas. Barry, you know, as you shared with us just a moment ago that you when teaching your own classes, this is something that you really have the opportunity to share with your students what this experience is like in getting a PhD and kind of contrasting it to what, you know, those first 2 years of general ed are like, which is I think so helpful to hear, especially for, you know, the students at the community college level. Like for example, at Valley College, many of them are first generation college students, and they're forging the path, you know, for the first time for their family. For you and your own experience and your own journey, did you have other family members or extended family, anybody who had sort of gone as far as you've gone with the PhD, or were you in the situation of sort of figuring it out on your own, or how did kind of support system work for you in getting to where you're at?
Yeah, great question. I did have a fairly distant uncle who had a PhD. And ironically, he was in educational psychology too, but I had almost no contact with him my whole life. So I didn't really know him. I met him for the first time when I was a high school senior, and that was the only time that I had ever met him. So I didn't have a lot of folks that went on to graduate school that I learned from. Both my parents did go to college, so I did have that benefit of parents that understood the college environment and kind of navigating the process. But graduate school, I was, you know, pretty much on my own and figured out things on my own, made some mistakes, you know, jumped into things and tried it out, where I was kind of naive to all the challenges that I would be experiencing. So maybe in many ways, ignorance was bliss, you know. I want to emphasize for the folks that might be at the community college, especially those in psychology, you're going to go get a PhD. It's not going to be hard. It's certainly not going to be harder than what you're experiencing right now. It's even going to be easier. And you're going to continue on, and you're going to get your PhD. You'll get your bachelor's. You'll go on and get your master's and PhD. The funding for college gets easier later, A lot of PhD programs are fully funded, so you don't have to stress about how you're going to pay for college as much as you certainly would at the lower division level and the undergraduate level. You're going to continue on. The more degrees you have, the more opportunities that you have. The folks who have PhDs have a tremendous amount of opportunity, that of jobs, of different things that they can pursue. They get a lot of choice, a lot of flexibility, and that's just a very powerful thing. So never look at just one more step and saying, okay, that's good enough, I'll be done. Keep going, because it gets more and more interesting. It gets easier. It's going to be fun, rewarding work, and it's going to set you up for really lifelong opportunities.
So, Barry, I want to be able to save time to be able to talk about UCLA and your work at Valley College, just because I think the UCLA stuff especially is very relevant to where we are now in education. So I know you spent 19 years in at College of the Canyons. I hate to say, like, hey, let's just skip over it, but what are some of the big takeaways from your experience at College of the Canyons?
You know, I had a lot of opportunities at College of the Canyons. I went there being in charge of research, planning, and grants. But over the 19 years, had the opportunity to do a lot of different work, start a lot of programs, pursue a lot of resources of a variety of types for the college, problem solve some kind of challenging situations, and resolve a lot of complex issues, which was rewarding. From that experience, I took away that we can change anything. If there's anything that we don't like, if there's anything that isn't operating the way we think it should, I don't care if it's a rule that the college or the district has, if it's a state law, federal law, state regulations, anything to be changed. We could do anything to make the world a better place, to make things work better, to help remove barriers for folks. And that's what we ought to focus our time, our professional time, in doing. And that's really how I approach the work here. I look at what barriers, I'm constantly looking for barriers our students may be facing, for ways that I can improve. Valley College is an amazing, amazing college, but we could do even better. And I'm always just excited to get ideas for new things we can try and do. And all that, I think, was rooted in my work at College of the Canyons.
And College of the Canyons is a model college. I mean, it is the college that a lot of LA colleges try to copy, because you guys pilot a lot of innovation. And I think you have unique obstacles that you overcome, because since you're so far away from the rest of Southern California, you're always losing professors once they start getting jobs that are closer to LA. And despite that, when I got hired by College of the Canyons, it felt different. How I got hired, how they hired me, how they oriented me, how they fixed my benefits, every step of the way as a newly hired adjunct, it felt different, that I was taken care of, that I was monitored, and that I was told and expressly what the standard was. And it was different from any other college I was hired by. So you then went to UCLA?
I did. Well, from when I graduated from USC, I went to UCLA, and I did research there for 4 years in the School of Education.
So when I read your bio, I was very excited when I read this portion of it. Because, you don't want to walk in and see your boss, but you're curious who he is. And this is sort of right down my wheelhouse, because I was very interested in equity, always. And you came in the hotbed of time this is right after or right during or right after Pete Wilson, the last Republican governor of California, right?
Right, just before, right about that time.
Right, and affirmative action was removed from public schools, deciding who would come into schools, and that had distraught me a lot. You had Prop 87, which excluded undocumented students from public services, including colleges, which was eventually overturned, but had churned California into a strongly Democratic state when it had previously had Reagan and Wilson as strong Republican governors. And then you had Prop 227, which banned bilingual education, which was overwhelmingly overturned by voters later. And these are all sort of like in the news things that are going to happen. I mean, affirmative action is probably going to be removed by the Supreme Court. So I've been following the data from this for decades, just because this is sort of the laboratory of where we're probably going to go now that we have a conservative Supreme Court. What are some of the thoughts that you have from the research of this time? Because this was sort of ground zero for how do we change education to be more, I guess, Republican, and what was the impact of it?
You know, this is exactly why I love being here at Valley, is that to affect some real change for communities that need it. Historically, there's been a lot of communities that have been underserved by their educational systems. While I was at UCLA, I had the opportunity to evaluate large-scale urban reform that was looking to affect some change in the schools. Had access to some really powerful data sets to be able to take a hard look at how we were doing in education, especially for the communities that most needed the support and assistance. And then the other major piece of my work was large-scale assessment systems, statewide assessment systems. But from all that work and the opportunity to get to know some amazing activists like Maria Casillas and Thelma Melendez de Santana, it instilled to me the strong belief that we have an obligation to affect some change, to make educational opportunities available to our students. Too often, I think that we let different barriers get in the way, and we have to not accept that. My kids' school, they have an amazing, all the schools that they've gone to have been absolutely amazing. There is an expectation that no barrier gets in the way of every kid achieving, truly every kid achieving. These are public schools too. Every school needs to have that same focus, that same ethic, and we need to as well. So as we see the college going rates in our local schools, our local communities not being what they are, we have to demand that change. We have to look for how we can help affect that change. And too often it's barriers that we put into place. You know, many of them come from the state legislature, and they may have been well-intentioned, but we have to remove every barrier that our students might face and making sure that kids have access to college, that everyone has access to college, and we improve the college going rates so that they have the opportunities that they deserve. Our relationships with our local schools have to improve. We can't partner in really profound ways. And I know that all of our local schools are entirely open to partnering with us and looking to have the change, to being the part of the change that we all are aspiring to. And we just have to get that work done. While I was at UCLA, I studied a lot of different educational systems, and I saw many, many, many ways where it didn't work, where things just didn't work. The schools didn't work for their local communities. The kids for decades were not achieving the educational outcomes that they needed to achieve. And the impact on those kids and those communities is they really were not set up well in life. It just wasn't fair how they were set up leaving their educational systems. and expected to compete with kids that came from schools that were really strong. And one of the most powerful pieces of research that I did showed it wasn't the characteristic of the kid. It was the characteristic of the school. So it wasn't that a kid was Latinx or African-American or Black. It wasn't that a kid was low income. It was depending on the characteristics of the school, whether or not the kid would achieve. So a low income kid, a Latinx kid from an affluent school outperformed the white kid or the not low income kid in a poor school. It was the characteristics of the school, the expectations of the school that determined what the achievement levels were. And we just quite simply have to not accept that anymore. And like I said, I know that our K-12 partners are with us on this. I know that they want to see all of their kids succeed. They're doing important work. And in fairness, that research I was just referencing is, you know, 20-some years old, so it doesn't reflect the schools of today. But I am excited about being here, about working with the local schools here in North Hollywood, Van Nuys, Panorama City, all of our local communities, and making sure that every kid has the opportunity to go to college and that we take away every barrier. We make it, you know, easy. It's just the natural next step for them is to go to college. We have a long ways to go, but through programs like dual enrollment, the work that's being done with our local schools and the expansion of dual enrollment programs, I'm convinced it's going to have profound impacts and help transform communities. And again, I just want to underscore how much I appreciate the K-12 partners, their openness to do this work with us. I also love the idea of embedding social justice programs in this work. So offering ethnic studies courses through dual enrollment. I know that our youth want to engage with those topics. These are areas that are passionate. You know, I talk to my kids about these issues all the time. It's what ignites their passion. And Scott, you're talking about courses that ignite the light. This is what we need to do. This is what we need to offer and get kids excited about continuing on their educational journeys and making sure that they have the degrees that they need to be successful and compete and have opportunities in life.
Dr. Gribbins, when you came to Valley College, it wasn't long thereafter that the pandemic happened and there was this huge sort of transition that you've been in the position of president for. Now that we're, you know, gearing up for our next semester here and we're kind of looking into the future and with everything that you were just describing about the opportunities that we have with dual enrollment, the opportunities for sort of a much stronger, cleaner pipeline that goes from the high schools to the college. And then when they're at the college, all the work that we're trying to do with guided pathways and the importance of access and framing that in terms of access really is equity. And then once they're here, we have to have the right infrastructure at the college to ensure that they stay here and that we get them through and that they complete. What do you sort of see now as, you know, if we look into the future, which I know the crystal ball is certainly cloudy, you know, it's hard to make these kind of predictions, but maybe a different way of framing it. For the next few years here, as we're sort of coming on the other side of the pandemic, what are you most excited about? Is it continuing these relationships with dual enrollment? Do you see some other aspects that we can really be kind of working towards as a community? We have just about another 5 minutes here or so with your time here. And so just want to try to get a sense kind of what you're looking at as we move forward.
Yeah, we have simply three strategic goals at Valley: access, equity, and success. And I think so much of the work all of the work can be pinned to simply those three goals. With access, making sure that we offer dual enrolled classes for every high school student. So any high school and every high school student that wants to enroll in a dual enrolled class, that they have access to it. We've grown the program tremendously from 40 sections to 80 to 90 sections per semester. We need to keep going to 275 sections. And then that's the scale that we're really having the dramatic impact that we need to. our outreach teams, being able to get back in person with the schools is huge. Getting students engaged with our individual programs so our arts folks can directly engage with the high school students and help them understand what opportunities are available in the arts, in STEM areas, the humanities, social sciences, getting students excited about those opportunities, the courses, and what it's going to be like. We're right now about 13,000 students. We should be 23,000 students. And I won't be satisfied that we're really having the reach, that we're really in welcoming our local kids as well as we need to until we reach that 23,000. I should also give a special call out for our LGBTQ students. We need to make sure that everyone feels safe and welcome here at Valley College. Absolutely critical. On the equity part, we've declared that we're going to be an anti-racist college. And we are going to eliminate disproportionate impacts from all groups of students. We've got a great start. We have some amazing programs. Our Emoja Black Scholars Program with Dr. Coney and so many wonderful, wonderful faculty is just amazing model. Our Dream Resource Center, absolutely terrific in supporting our undocumented students. We're creating a Rainbow Pride Center that we're excited about opening soon, hopefully in just a few months once we get the campus center back online. All of the programs that we have designed to make sure that students are welcome, supported, are absolutely, absolutely marvelous, very unique in higher education. It's not common that you see the collection of programs that we have here to help support students. And I'm so appreciative and thankful for all the amazing, passionate people who are doing that work. And then on the completion side, we're going to have the highest completion rates in the state of California. No one's settling for what's good enough for this population of student or whatever they might try to discount, the highest in the state of California. And there's already been, as you know, Scott, amazing groundwork laid through the Guided Pathways framework that people have been working through. So much wonderful, wonderful work's been done with our CAPS or meta majors, with our completion teams for each of the CAPS to help make sure that no student gets lost, that we help really guide students through their entire educational journey. Support students through their entire educational journey. Absolutely, absolutely critical work. And it's quite simply those three things. So access, equity, and success. Once we're 23,000 students, once we have eliminated disproportionate impacts, and hand in hand with that is being an anti-racist college and having the highest completion in the state, then we will be where we need to be. And we need to get there quickly. Not 10 years from now, we need to get there quickly.
Barry, let me ask you this. What advice would you have to a student who says, you know what, I would like to be in a position to make calls on things, to be able to sort of make big decisions affecting thousands of people? What is the reward of it? And what is the recommendation of what are sort of the core aspects of helping you get to where you are?
You know, for me, it's just a matter of working hard and trying to serve others. I never approach it from wanting to make big decisions affecting large numbers of people, but rather what can I do to serve other folks and to help others? And I think as we work hard to do that, that we can have some pretty profound impacts. And you might realize after doing it for a few decades that you've really had some profound impacts and made a difference for thousands of people. But the focus is just each every day working really hard and trying to do our best to help others.
Dr. Gribbins, thank you so much for being so generous with your time this afternoon and sharing with us the pathway that brought you from Santa Clarita to Valley College and all the steps in between. It was very inspiring to hear your story, and it's really exciting to hear you share your vision for where we're going as a college here at Los Angeles Valley College. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Scott and John. Good to see you both.
Yeah, thank you so much.